First Peter was all about encouraging the saints, the church, to bear up under persecution. The second letter is about false teachers and false prophets. And Peter's encouraging the church to bear up under those. So he says this in chapter 3, starting at verse 1. By the way, we're going to be talking a lot about the flood tonight and things that changed during the flood, but we're going to start here in 2 Peter chapter 3. This is now, beloved, the second letter I'm writing to you, in which I'm stirring up your sincere mind by way of reminder, that you should remember the words spoken beforehand by the holy prophets and the commandment of the Lord and the Savior spoken by your apostles. Know this first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts, and saying, "Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. But by his word, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men." Mockers say, "Oh, God's never done anything. Everything's been the same." And Peter says, "Oh." It escapes their notice. He uses the phrase in the King James, I think it's willingly ignorant. And I like what one guy said about that phrase. He said it means dumb on purpose. But they are. They're willingly ignorant of the fact that God has not left everything the same since creation. And the main thing he brings up here is the flood and how drastically things change with the flood. As you can imagine, the entire surface of the earth being covered with water, and that it was destroyed. Peter also mentioned the flood in his first letter, talking about how Noah and his family were saved. Interestingly, how he puts it, by the water. The water saved them. And I would have thought, well, didn't the ark save them from the water? But the idea is not the physical salvation through the ark, but rather the spiritual salvation through the water, washing away the evil of the world. And that's what took place during the flood. But if we go back to the record of the flood, let's go start in Genesis chapter 8. Well, actually, chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. We start talking about the flood in earnest in chapter 6, but there is something we need to understand about the way things worked at the time from chapter 2. And you probably know this, but if you don't, it's one of the interesting things that changes. We will talk about at least eight things that changed during the flood. So in chapter 2, it says, verse 4, Genesis 2, 4, "This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven. Now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted, for the Lord had not sent rain upon the earth. There was no man to cultivate the ground." What did it say? God had not sent rain upon the earth. "But a mist used to rise from the earth and water the whole surface of the ground." So that's the way it worked at the beginning. No rain, but rather a mist rising from the ground. And that's what watered the entire earth. So when you get to chapter 6, and God says to Noah he's going to bring a flood, God is not specific in how he's going to do this. But we know from the record that it rained. How long did it rain? 40 days and 40 nights. So the first thing that changed is we now have this thing called rain, this natural phenomena, if you will. Natural because God has built it into nature, and there was no rain before. And this, to me, is interesting. Keep a finger there in Genesis and open the New Testament once again to Hebrews chapter 11. And this is what the writer says there. Hebrews chapter 11. We looked at Hebrews 11, 6 this morning. Tonight we're looking at Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7. And did I say we looked at Hebrews 6 this morning? I said that this morning, didn't I? I just can't. Hebrews 11, 6, we looked at this morning, and tonight we're looking at Hebrews 11, 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things, and how does he describe them? Not yet seen. Being warned by God about things not yet seen. Does this mean the flood? They haven't seen a flood yet. But what else have they not seen, apparently, according to chapter 2? They had not even seen rain. So they have not yet seen rain. And the Hebrew writer is bringing us up to date on this idea, saying Noah, being warned by God, by faith, prepared the ark. And he prepared it for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So think about the faith Noah would have had. God says, I'm going to bring a flood. I don't know that God explained it to him. There's nothing in the text that says God explained the details. He just said there's going to be a flood. I don't know that he told Noah, I'm going to make water come down out of the sky. We'll call it rain. How about if we do that? I don't know that any of those things took place. I just know from the text that God said, I'm going to bring a flood to destroy all life on the earth. I want you to build this boat. And what did Noah do? He did everything just like God commanded him. That's what Noah did. And so he built the ark, and when the flood came, just as the text said, Noah was saved by the ark. But what was he really saved by in the final analysis? His faith. He was saved by his faith because he believed God. Against, we might say, the natural way things were, because the flood was a different thing. It hadn't been a flood like that before. It hadn't even been rain before. But God says, you get ready for it. And sure enough, it came. Second thing that changed. Chapter 8 and verse 21. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, because when the flood was over and Noah and his family stepped out on dry ground, the first thing Noah did was build an altar and offered sacrifices. Do you remember when he loaded up the animals? God said, I want you to take two of every kind except four clean animals. And how many clean? Seven. And there's some controversy over whether it's seven of each of those or seven pairs. But at any rate, there was a higher number of animals that were clean that were to be taken on the ark. And don't miss the fact that even at this stage, prior to the law, there were some animals that were considered clean and some that were considered unclean. And so these were the animals that were offered for sacrifice after the flood. But here's what happens. Verse 21 of chapter 8, Genesis 8, 21. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. Now here is an aside. To me, this is a very encouraging passage, because God is spelling it out for us here in the 8th chapter, very early on in Genesis. The intent of man's heart is evil. And when does that start? From his youth. God knows what we are made of, and he still wants to save us. To me, the idea, and I think the New Testament bears this out, this body of flesh that is so much of a problem to us now, because this flesh wants the things of this world, we'll not have to contend with this body of flesh anymore. When we are resurrected, we'll receive a glorified body. You can read about that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And John also mentions that in 1 John chapter, is it 4, where he says it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know we will be like him, his resurrected body, Jesus' resurrected body, so we'll be different. But at this point, we still have our flesh, and that is our biggest problem. And God says, I know that. Every intention of man's heart's evil from his youth. That's the way it is. And so I'm not going to curse the ground anymore for his sake. When did he start cursing the ground? Chapter 3. You look at chapter 3 and verse 17, Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit. God comes to the serpent and says, here's what I'm going to do about you, tempting Eve to eat that fruit. And then he goes to Eve, here's what I'm going to do about you because you ate the fruit. Then he goes to Adam, here's what I'm going to do for you because you ate the fruit. One of the things he's going to do is curse the ground. And it's not going to produce for you like it has. It's going to bring forth thorns and thistles, poison oak, poison sumac, whatever else you can think of that you don't want in your backyard or anywhere else. That stuff's going to be coming up. And that's the way it was. And Adam had to work very hard, and all humanity had to work very hard to make a living from the ground. And so it says that the ground is cursed in chapter 3, and then in chapter 5, we read this in verse 28. Lamech lived 182 years, and if you wonder what he looked like, there he is, right down here, sitting next to Jeannie. If you were here for VBS, you know what I'm talking about. Bob dressed up like Lamech, the father of Noah, because that's who we're talking about here. He lived to be 182 years. You look pretty good, Bob. And he became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah, saying, this one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. So Lamech has this boy, names him Noah, and he says, and the Holy Spirit said, write that in the book, that he said this boy would give us rest from the work of our hands with regard to the curse that's on the ground, and how hard we have to work to make a living by bringing a crop from the ground. And so in chapter 8 and verse 21, sure enough, God says, I'll never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart's evil from his youth. It's almost as if God is saying, you can't fix this, so I might as well just let him make a living from the ground and grow something to eat without cursing it. It's kind of like that. It's almost the same thing when you read Deuteronomy 24, and God is allowing in the law an exception for divorce. If you find some uncleanness in your wife, you can give her a writing of divorce, and she can go and be somebody else's husband, but she can't come back to you. And then what did Jesus say about that? Matthew 19, Jesus said, that was because of the hardness of your hearts. It's like God's in heaven saying, what am I going to do with these people? How am I going to fix this? They're such goobers. I'm going to have to make some exceptions to the way things really ought to be, and that seems to be what he's doing. So he says, I'm going to curse the ground for Adam, and then when the flood is over, he says, I'm going to remove this curse. I know the thought of their intent of their hearts is evil from youth, and I'm not going to curse the ground anymore for their sake. So that curse is gone. Thank the Lord. All right. Verse 22, chapter 8, verse 22. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. Until global warming starts, or climate change, or whatever it is. By the way, I don't want to make a political commentary, but if you look at things historically, has our Earth's climate ever changed? You remember hearing anything about an ice age? And apparently there has been more than one. And why was Greenland called Greenland? It was originally green. It was verdant. What's verdant mean? That's if you're a Mexican and it's green. That's what that word comes from. Verdant, green, lush. That's the way Greenland used to be. That's why they called it Greenland, and things changed. So, yes, there's some change. But don't let somebody pressure you into some political decision based on that, because what does God say? until I come back. Seed time and harvest, cold heat, summer, winter, day and night shall not cease. This is the way it's going to be until I come back. So it's almost as if God could see coming down the pike. One of these days, they're going to try to manipulate people with climate scares. So I need to put something in the book that'll prevent that. And that's exactly what he has done. Now, all that was a little tongue-in-cheek, by the way. Now, what does this mean about how things were prior to the flood? I don't know. There is some speculation, and I'm just throwing this out there in case you hear it. It'll be something you're somewhat familiar with. There is speculation that prior to the flood, there was this water above the earth that was acting as an insulator and a filter, and it changed the air pressure on the earth so that the increase in air pressure was something that provided every creature more oxygen, which makes sense. Because what's one thing you notice about all the animals and sometimes even people that we dig up out of the fossilized remains that are left? They were big. They were large. And so it may be that there was an increased amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. This is speculation. The Bible doesn't say this. But just to kind of help us make sense of this and some possibilities, maybe all that changed when God brought the flood. So there's some possibilities. All right. Chapter 9, verses 2 and 3. Actually, start with verse 1. Then God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." That's nothing new. That's what Adam and Eve were originally told. But the next part is new. "The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give it all to you, as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood." And there it is, life's in the blood. We didn't have to wait for the law of Moses for that to be true. God says, I want you to know about that right here. Although technically, Genesis is part of the law that God gave Moses, but people knew about this long before Moses got the law on Sinai. So, prior to this, nobody ate animals. God gave the plants and the seed in the plants as food, and nobody ate animals. But now that the flood has come, going to be eating animals now. Not only will you eat the animals, how will the animals respond to you? They're going to be scared of you. That's occasionally, you get out in the woods, you're hunting, and you come across a deer that doesn't run away from you. I can't shoot those deer. I have to wait for one that I believe is afraid of me will run away. Is it a moral issue? I suspect that the ones that don't run away would taste just as good as the ones that would run away. But I just have a problem taking them in like that. So, animal flesh, you can eat it. When somebody says, "Oh, if you want to be a real spiritual person, you need to be a vegan," well, take them back to Genesis chapter 9. Say, "No, if you want to be a real spiritual person, you need to eat animals." That's what they're for now. Just don't eat the blood. So not only are we to eat animals, that's another change, but there's another change in verse 5. God says, "Surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast. I will require it. And from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man." What's he saying? By the way, who's there? Noah and his family. Noah, Mrs. Noah, Ham, Shem, Japheth, and Mrs. Ham, Shem, and Japheth. That's the only ones there. And God tells Noah, all right, here's the way it's going to be from here on out. Somebody kills somebody. What are you obligated to do? You kill them. And it's interesting, it doesn't say you have permission to do this or I authorize you to do this. It says, I'm going to require your lifeblood. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. That sounds to me like he's directing Noah and his family to bring about capital punishment on anybody who commits murder. And the only people there at this point are Noah and his family. I wonder if they were all looking around at each other like, well, I don't think we need to worry too much about that. Where's this coming from? Why did God have to destroy the world in the first place? You go back to chapter 6, and it says twice that the world was a violent place. God spoke to Noah about how things were in chapter 6 in verse 11, and it says, now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. And behold, I'm about to destroy them with the earth. Where did that start? Well, you go back to chapter 4. It says in chapter 4, a fellow by the name of Lamech. Now, this isn't the same Lamech that was the father of Noah. This was a previous Lamech. And Lamech says, chapter 4, verse 23, says to his wives, Ada and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech. For I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain's avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. It's like it's a little tiny hint of where things were starting to go. Cain rose up against his brother and killed him. Somebody rose up against Lamech, and Lamech said, well, if Cain's avenged 7 times, I'm going to be avenged 77 times. And then you get to chapter 6, and the earth is filled with violence so much that God says, I'm going to wipe it out. Now that we've got everything cleaned up, here's the way it's going to be. God says to Noah, somebody kills somebody else, you kill them. And like Barney Fife used to say, that will nip it in the bud. Who was it? Some Western said, the guy just needed killing. Something like that. Well, I think there's a lot of folks in the world like that now. And Peter mentions that same thing. Talks about people who are like brute beasts made to be captured and killed. It's a sad truth of the world. All right. Next thing that changes. Chapter 9, verses 8 to 17. God's not going to destroy the earth anymore with a flood, but he gives us a promise. God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. I will establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there be again a flood to destroy the earth. That's interesting. God doesn't just tell this to Noah and his family, but he says, this covenant I'm making, it's with every living thing. Because he had destroyed every living thing with the flood, except for Noah and the animals on the ark. But now he says, I'm making this covenant. I'm never going to do this again. Once is enough. Verse 12, God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I'm making between me and you, every living creature that's with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. So, every time you see that rainbow, it goes right back to Genesis chapter 9. Think about that. This is the first time people saw a rainbow. It was after the flood. This is why when you see so many artistic representations of the flood and the ark, perhaps on Mount Ararat, what do you see along with that but the rainbow? You go in Miss Debbie's classroom down there. She's got a picture up on the wall. It's kind of a cartoonish thing, but it's got the rainbow in it because it's an integral part of this story. And you see that bow that didn't exist before the flood, and you know God has put that there as a promise. Never going to destroy the earth with water again. But it's like that song we sang it, I think, once during VBS. It's going to rain. It's going to rain. Oh, you better get ready. Bear this in mind. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. It said it won't be water, but fire next time. So next time it's going to be fire. Won't have to worry about any bows with fire. Just stop, drop, and roll, all you people that don't believe in the Lord. It's just a little Christian humor there. It won't work. It won't work. All right. Chapter 11, 10 through 11. Longevity. Have you ever noticed when you're reading, because I know everybody loves to read the chronologies about so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so. In chapter 5, I know I told you chapter 11, keep a finger in chapter 11, but look at first chapter 5 so we can make a comparison here. Chapter 5, verse 3 says this, when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness according to his image and named him Seth. Now, if you back up to the end of chapter 4, it talks about Cain and Abel having been previously, but now that's all over and he's gone in to have relations with Eve again. And now, how old is he? He's 130. I think that's a good time to start a family. Wait till you're about 130. You might have something in mind how to do it by that time. So he's 130 and he has Seth. And then you go down to verse 6. Seth lived 105 years and he became the father of Enosh. And then you look at verse 9. Enosh lived 90 years and he became the father of Kenan. And you just go right down through the chapter and you see how old these guys were when they started having their children. And it's really astounding. And they lived to great long ages. As a matter of fact, who was the oldest guy? Methuselah, 969 years old. And if you do the math, it sure looks like he died during the year of the flood. And by the time Abraham was born, think about this. No, not Abraham, I'm sorry. When Noah was born, Adam would have still been around for another 56 years or so. Wouldn't that have been something to meet Adam? You're the guy. You're the first one. And what would you say? Say, lift up your shirt so I can see that there's no belly button. You ever thought about that? See, you didn't know you were going to learn that tonight, did you? I'm assuming, I don't think God built a belly button into him, but there wouldn't be a need for one since he made him out of the dirt rather than his mama. So you go to chapter 11 now, and you start seeing things change in the chronology. You start out with some pretty aged guys having children. Verse 10, these are the records of the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old. Became the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arpachshad. He had other sons and daughters, and Arpachshad lived 35 years. Whoa! See, you guys have been waiting 130 years or so to have kids, and now Arpachshad, he's waited 35, and now he's becoming a dad. He became the father of Selah. Arpachshad lived 400 years and 403 years after he became the father of Shelah, and he had other sons and daughters. Shelah lived 30 years and became the father of Eber. And you go right on down the line, they're starting to have children at much younger ages. And if you look at the total years that they lived, they are dropping off radically. Why that is, I have no idea, except, well, I've got some theories. You can ask me about those later, but some of the things I've already mentioned may figure into that. But I just wanted you to see, people lived up into the 900s prior to the flood, and now that the flood's over, that stops, and things are coming way down below that. What did David write about man's longevity in the Psalms? He said, man's days are 70, and if by reason of strength, 80. And that has pretty much held until this day. And that he wrote is about 3,000 years old. So not much has changed in that 3,000-year period. And of course, it depends on the circumstances in which people live. But pretty much it's in the 70 to 80 range. The one last thing I'll mention, and you can take a look at this on your own. I didn't bring any pictures because I knew this would take more time than we have. The entire surface of the earth changed with the flood. There is good evidence that before the flood, there was one large mass of land. The creation account even seems to be pointing that out, that God separated the waters from the waters and separated the land from the waters. And the dry land he called earth. Anyway, if you look at a global map that shows the fissures in the oceans, you can see where the continents appear to have separated from one another, like the pictures in a jigsaw puzzle. And if you could push them all towards each other, it looks like they would all fit into one large mass of land. And so it's conjectured. The Bible doesn't say this for sure, but it looks like the continents were split up. And there were no continents prior to, well, there was one continent prior to this, it looks like. But that's just one thing to consider. Another thing that definitely changed was the surface. Everywhere you go in the world, the crust of the earth is covered with waterborne sediment. Waterborne sediment. And you can read the secular theories about this. They say, well, there was a large inland ocean here, and there was a large inland ocean there. As a matter of fact, there was a pretty much a large inland ocean everywhere you go. And that's why we have whales fossilized on top of mountains. What else would you expect to find? Well, what is petroleum? Petroleum is organic material that's been buried in the ground and buried deep. What's natural gas? Well, natural gas is what you get when organic material decomposes. It gives off a gas, and that gas is trapped in the earth as if all of that organic material had at one time been buried. What have you got when you're talking about coal? Coal is nothing but organic material that's been buried under a different circumstance and compressed, and it has become coal. All of those things, oil, gas, and coal, are called something. What are they called in today's world? They're called fossil fuels. Isn't that interesting? All buried in the ground and at some great depths. How did all of that happen? Well, there was this local flood. They had a big rainstorm come up overnight. No. Genesis says the great fountains of the deep burst open. When God brings the flood, he brings the flood. He covered, the text says, all the highest mountains, and the highest mountain was covered by about 21 feet of water. And that flood lasted for several months, about a year, before it all completely subsided. And so you take a look into that and you'll see how the surface of the earth changed with the flood. These are just some things. What's the point of talking about all this? Well, we ought to know these things, I think. I think we ought to be familiar. We ought to be looking at the scriptures and thinking about things, not just in terms of, yeah, God told Noah there's going to be a flood, and so he built this ark, put some animals on it, and then he got saved. That's the general story, but there's more to it than that. And there's just something in me. If God puts it in the book, I think we ought to talk about it. You come to your own conclusions. You let these things build your faith as you see fit. You think about these. You meditate on these things and see what good they are. But I know they've done me a lot of good through the years, especially when I hear and I read people who say, that Bible, you can't trust it. Just a bunch of stories. And then you drive through one of these cut-throughs where they've had to cut through a large mound of ground, and you'll see the layers of sediment. And you got to ask yourself, where did all those layers of sediment come from, if not the flood? By the way, it's not just layers of sand and silt. It's layers of volcanic ash in some places, very deep. Fascinating. You take a look at it yourself. You do your own study on sediment. One last thing on sediment. A lot of them are curved. When water lays out sediment, it lays it out flat. But if the earth is still moving while that sediment is wet, then it'll curve that sediment, and that's what you see in a lot of places in the earth. You see that the earth was still volatile and moving after the sediment had been placed on it, and that's why those sediments have been twisted and curved. That's probably a good place to stop. Bobby's got a song of invitation ready. I don't know what need you might have tonight, but if you've got one and you'd like to talk to some of us about it, whether it's a salvation of your soul or a prayer for you or a family member, whatever it might be, we want to hear from you as we stand and sing the invitation song.